And welcome to the Asian American and Asian Research Institute's Friday Lecture Series online edition. Thank you everyone for joining us at home. Tonight we're honored to have with us Christopher Kwok and Karen King to present and discuss their recently released report by the Asian American Bar Association of New York titled, A Rising Tide of Hate and Violence Against Asian Americans in New York During COVID-19, Impact Causes Solutions. They discuss the anti-Asian hate and violence, which has skyrocketed in 2020, and focus on the New York City region. For those seeking resources in regards to anti-Asian incident reporting and education material, including the Bar Association's report, there's no better place to visit than the Research Institute's website, where we have amassed a large collection under our recent project, CUNY Forum Volume 8, Corona Conversations. From there, you can also purchase our limited edition, print edition of Corona Conversations in my background over here. And now let me introduce our two speakers. Christopher M. Kwok is a mediator and arbitrator with JAMS, specializing in labor and employment law. He was previously the alternative dispute resolution coordinator at the U.S. Equal Employment Commission in the New York District Office. Mr. Kwok serves as the board director and issues committee chair for the Asian American Bar Association of New York. He is also an adjunct professor Hunter College CUNY, my alma mater for my bachelor's degree, and the New York City College of Technology CUNY. Mr. Kwok received his BA from Cornell University with a major in government and minor in Asian American studies. He earned his JD from UCLA Law School, where he was the editor of the Asian American Pacific Islander Journal, Law Journal. Ms. Karen King is partner at Morvillo and Bromovitz.
That's a hard one.
An ISN and an LLPC, and she has over 20 years of experience in complex commercial litigation, BSA and AML and OFAC compliance and enforcement matters, securities litigation and regulation, internal investigations and strategic advice. Karen has also served as the vice chair of the Pro Bono and Community Service Committee for the Asian American Bar Association of New York. She has been recognized for her commitment to pro bono work. She was the recipient of the Federal Bar Association's Thurgood Marshall Award for exceptional pro bono service in 2019, as well as the pro bono award from the National Asian Pacific American Bar Association. She received her JD from Harvard Law School in 2000, where she was the editor of the Journal of Law and Technology, and her BA is from Yale University. Before our speakers begin, I just want to frame the present moment that we, the Asian American community, are currently dealing with. Since the release of the Bar Association report, the numbers of incidences of anti-Asian bias, harassment, violence seems to have only continued to increase. According to the reporting forum, Stop AAPI Hate, located in California, there have been 3,800 anti-Asian incidences recorded from March 2020 to the end of February 2021 nationwide. And mostly were against women. These stats, of course, do not include the horrific shooting that happened last month in Atlanta, which included six Asian women victims who lost their lives. And this past Monday, a Filipino woman on her way to church was assaulted just a couple avenues away from our office on 43rd Street by someone. And recently on Tuesday, AAPI data came out with their survey report, which found that Asian Americans were least likely to report hate incidences, which might have to do with their fear of retaliation, as well as a concern over whether justice will be served. So with that context in mind, please welcome Chris and Karen to discuss their report.
I'll go ahead and share my screen where we have a short sort of some PowerPoint slides to help guide the conversation. So this is the title, of course, of the paper, which you can access through the websites, and we can also try to post this during our conversation today. Just very in broad strokes, we're going to walk through some of the themes of the report. And for context, the reason why the Asian American Bar Association of New York decided to put together this report was because the rate of anti-Asian hate incidents was starting to rise and was very clearly trending upwards at the very beginning of the pandemic, really even before the shutdown. And it really wasn't getting enough press attention. It wasn't getting enough recognition within the community that this is a problem and it's going to become an increasing problem. And so we thought it was important to document what was happening in our communities, in our city, and make sure that there is a record of this really troubling trend as the pandemic continued to see more and more of these anti-Asian incidents. We also thought it was important as a discussion piece to put in one place some of the historical sort of trends and historical events with anti-Asian hate in the country and how it does tend to rise and come back during times of stress, whether it's economic stress or a health crisis. So this is not a new incident. It's not a new trend. Unfortunately, there is a cycle that's really appearing across the history of this country. And, you know, as a corollary to that, we wanted to examine some of the root causes for why these things happen as the stress levels rise. And we wanted to find solutions and at least propose concrete ideas for discussion, because this is a very complex issue. Race relations in this country, as everyone knows, is a very sensitive, very complex problem. And it really takes discussion and people having transparent and open dialogue about these issues to try to advance the ball and move things forward towards some solutions. Hopefully we can address this immediate problem, but also help prevent these types of incidents in the future. So just to begin with this very first slide, this tracks, of course, the rise of anti-Asian hate incidents. You can see in the line graph at the bottom that there was a clear spike going up starting at the end of 2019. In the past few years, you see very, very low numbers of anti-Asian hate incidents, and you see a 12-fold increase happening at the beginning of the pandemic. And even though there are issues with reporting and underreporting, those incidents that have been reported saw a sharp rise, according to statistics of the NYPD. And many, many Americans across the country have reported seeing these incidents happen, whether or not they're reported. So there was a clear uptick in these types of incidents as the pandemic was unfolding. In terms of the types of incidents, this graph shows the most common, which is harassment, name calling, and shunning. We were seeing already physical assaults. It's very tragic that after our report came out, there were these extremely violent incidents that unfolded, obviously, in the last month and so. But across the year, up to the point of the report, we were looking at data that was collected from multiple organizations. And obviously the vast majority, we were seeing a lot of harassment and just sort of name calling and shoving. In New York, that would be a lot on the public transportation. But there were certainly incidents of physical assault, coughing, a lot of just direct vandalism of Asian properties and storefronts. And that sort of thing. So this diagram just shows you the breakdown of what we were seeing in New York. One of the other things we noted in the report was that Asian Americans have a much higher proportion of representation among healthcare workers. The small business owners in the state and the city were also, you know, there are more Asians in that population as well. And so the community was really feeling the brunt of the effects of the pandemic from a very, very early stage as the crisis was unfolding. Unemployment among Asian Americans was higher than other groups. And so the combination of this sort of disproportionate impact and pain, and then you have on top of this a lot of this anti-Asian hate that was really kind of a terrible perfect storm happening. As I mentioned, our report does trace, and I'm not going to go into all the details, but it does trace the history of anti-Asian sentiment across, you know, this country's history, including the Chinese Exclusion Act in the late 1800s. Of course, the Japanese internment camps during World War II. There were lots of incidents in the rise, the economic stress points when the automobile industry, for example, was seeing this sort of anti-Japanese sentiment, which led to the killing of Vincent Chin, a Chinese citizen. And then we have hate incidents that follow the 9/11 attacks with some of our Southeast Asian community members. And of course, during the Trump administration and even during his campaign, there was a lot of this anti-Asian sentiment that was leading to incidents. So again, not a new phenomenon, unfortunately, and really it is showing a cycle of repeated action as we look through things. Some of the challenges that you know, we face in trying to look at the trends here, we have a history, of course, of hate and violence that have to be overcome. We have a lot of incomplete data. Not a ton of fulsome reporting, and so the underreporting incidents is an issue in trying to examine the volume of what's actually happening and to get a precise estimate of the incidents. We also have the cycle of inaction, unfortunately, because over the last year, a lot of organizations have gone out and said, please, please, please report so that we can try to take action and so that the police can actually see what's happening. And despite an uptick in the reporting, there has been just very little action on the criminal justice side. And that has, I think, increased the frustration. It harms the goal of trying to report and get justice for our community. And so that's a cycle that's a very, very big challenge here. And lack of charges brought by prosecutors, a lack of convictions, of course. And, you know, from a legal perspective, we have challenges trying to figure out the legal standards and balancing the need to, you know, find concrete evidence to meet those standards, but also recognizing some of the context of what's happening and figuring out different ways to meet the legal standards when the evidence is there and it's not being collected. And then the final challenge I think we wanted to talk about was the social and political conflict among minority groups and the sensitivities of dealing with our fellow minority communities, trying to work together to find solutions and you know, not finger pointing and blaming and sort of balancing that act of victims' rights, but also wanting to you know, support a fair and equal justice system. So those are just the big challenges. I think I want to turn it over to Chris. I've been talking too much to talk a bit about some of the perspectives that we've seen in the community, as well as some of the initiatives. I have a slide following this on the initiatives that we're proposing in the paper. And then we can have a conversation.
Yeah, thank you so much, Karen. You know, that's always, you know, love to go have Karen go first because you've really made this report possible. So, you know, with your resources and that she brought and the attention, you know, Abney would not have been able to do all the great work that we've been able to do. So, and it's always great to be here at RE because, as you know, there's nothing better than a Friday evening talking about Asian American related stuff. And Anthony knows that, you know, I've been there often. And so I wish I was there in person to replicate that, but being here on Zoom with you guys is enough, which is why I asked Karen and I asked to have you guys talk, because, I think much of this, evening will be us having a conversation. This is an important moment in Asian America and America as a whole. You know, one of the things that we've been asking is for more government action. That's going to be the quickest, you know, sort of, you know, way to deal with people's fear about safety, right? You know, for many Asian American, many Asian Americans, including my wife, they've really changed the way they go out. They've changed how they go out. They changed what kind of transportation they take. They don't take the subway anymore. They take, you know, sort of private you know, car service, stuff like that. And so Abney has said, you know, not without some pushback, that there is a role for police action and accountability here, and that people should be held accountable for their crimes and actions, and that there's a role for that. And that, you know, there's no way we could say that's not going to happen or shouldn't happen. We understand and we support BLM. We support, you know, the reformation of the police system and, you know, as a whole. But, you know, while we talk about it, while we're doing it, there's an immediate need for the Asian American community to be safe. And we think that, you know, that should happen. As you, many of you know, the Asian Hate Crimes Task Force was formed at the NYPD. One of the things that we've been pointing out is that that task force is not funded. There's no funding for it separately. It's a completely volunteer task force, which means that the police who are assigned to the task force are assigned on a volunteer basis. And so they're assigned to like robbery or something else. And then when there's an incident that requires their language ability, they might get called in for a day or two or three. But they're not the assigned investigator, which makes a lot of, which is really important within the NYPD. Like, who to whom is this matter entrusted? Because that's the person making all these decisions. And so the Asian Hate Crimes Task Force, and you've seen all the video, it looks great on PR. They're really dressed in really sharp suits and, you know, they're really doing great work. And, you know, this is not a critique of the officers who are volunteering their time on top of their regular duties, but it is a critique of the NYPD administration and, of course, of the mayor for not putting some real resources behind this effort. So we just wanted people to know that. So this is something that we've really sort of gone around talking to people to say, we need funding. Of course, this runs into the whole defund the police movement. And so when we say fund the police, you know, we've heard from opponents, no, defund the police. And that's been difficult for the community to have sort of a unified voice in front of city government about it. It's really put, you know, the brakes on some of the funding that we think is possible. We don't think that defund the police is, you know, opposite sort of funding the hate crimes task force at all, because I think no one can, oppose accountability for crimes that have been committed and holding people accountable for them and therefore having people feel a little bit safer. Of course, we recognize the injustice that has long pervaded our justice system and our police, and we want to reform it, and we support that as well. And, you know, as between, you know, sort of, you know, there's a Black versus Asian narrative that is, you know, resurging. You know, and so let's just not, you know, sort of shy away from it. That's what it is. There's no question that we've all seen videos and that there are attackers of all stripes. You know, quite honestly, if you want to talk about the most serious attacks, it's a white, you know, sort of perpetrator in Atlanta that killed 8 people, 6 of whom were Asian American, you know, and, you know, so that is also, you know, sort of not part of the narrative. And it was interesting how that was not part of the narrative media wise. You know, we don't have the video of the killings, you know, thank God, right? You know, that's not playing. But, you know, the Sheriff's Department, when they put out the press release the day of, quoted the killer. The killer told us it was not racial in nature. So it's very interesting how that narrative gets played out when it's, when the perpetrator is white. That being said, there is an issue between Asian and Black communities that we need to discuss, that we need to talk to each other and say, what's the animus that we have between us? You know, that we are kind of lashing out, that the Asian American community feels that African Americans are lashing out at them. I guess the one thing I would say that, you know, the African American community is not a monolith, just like we always say about the Asian American community. We're not a monolith. You know, the actions of some people do not represent them all. And, you know, I think about the Filipino woman who was just attacked in New York, you know, and there was a father and son African-American that held signs in front of the hotel. You know, the coronavirus is not Chinese, you know, Asian lives matter, you know, because they knew what narrative would get played out. But they were there to say, hey, we're here to tell you this is not a monolith. So I think that, you know, we look at it that way, that we not get caught up in that. And I think that that's important to do. Because in the end, it's the structural sort of, you know, implications that place us in conflict with one another. But we really need to get at sort of overall systems of white supremacy and structural racism that really are the root of this problem. So I think those are the root of the problems. And I think the anti-Asian sort of element that's there within African-American communities and the anti-Black elements that are within Asian-American communities. We have never worked those out, really. You know, we had the LA riots flash up in the 90s, 30 years of really dedicated community activists, and that kind of like died down. But those things are always there. Like, there's old wounds. We need to be honest. We need to have conversations. We need to have more friends that are Black, that, you know, if we're Asian, you know, we need to have friends that cross these color lines. You know, we need to do more. We're in a important moment in our Asian American movement that is unprecedented since 1968, 69, when the Asian American movement began. And so that, you know, we are really looking forward to participating in that new movement. And I just want to give it back to Karen. We can come back to it.
That sounds great. Why don't I go ahead and advance the slide. Our paper ends with our attempt to come up with some initiatives for discussion, concrete things that people can actually start working on. Some of these, of course, are much more challenging than others, but it is meant to put a step forward so that it's not just talk. And when politicians, you know, show support or corporations issue statements of support, there's actually something that is on the table that can be discussed that will advance the ball towards some solutions and prevention for the future. So one of them is, of course, the clear reporting mechanism for victims. One of the frustrations, I think, and the reason for underreporting is that the burden on the victim or the survivor is quite high. Putting yourself out there, talking to the police, talking to prosecutors, you know, making your presence and your incident public is a huge burden. And a lot of people don't want that kind of attention. And so finding ways that folks can report. Sometimes you can report anonymously. Sometimes you report and disclose your name, or there can be some kind of middle ground. But thinking about making the burden less onerous on the victims, I think, is one area where the criminal justice system could use some reform. Uniform and consistent classification and prosecution of hate crimes. This is definitely a big, I think, sore spot for what's happened over the last year. There are many incidents against multiple minority groups, and they're not always treated the same or with the same type of assumptions, whether it's being reported in the press or whether it's about how the police treat incidents. They don't see an attack on an Asian person necessarily as a potential hate crime. And that is a sort of approach that needs to be evaluated and reconsidered if we're going to have some consistency in our criminal justice system. And why don't I do one more and then turn it back to Chris. Greater representation of Asians in law enforcement, public service, in the courts, and just public life generally, I think is always something that we can work towards, because the more, you know, Asians and Asian faces that we have within these organizations, the more likely we can kind of affect change in the approaches of government organizations, and also have a little bit more dialogue at the highest levels of government. So Chris, why don't I turn it over to you for the last four here?
Yeah, thank you. You know, the public education campaign, you know, when we released the report, we did not anticipate that it was coming at the beginning of this moment. It's turning out to be a really historic moment. And we released it on February 11th. And we did it because in part, we were afraid that this would be forgotten, that this would not be talked about, this would not be recollected, and this would not be part of the national conscious in a way that it deserved to be. So that's why we did it. And so obviously the reason it's gotten attention is because of the continued harassment and violence, and then of course of the deaths, which is really terrible. And I think one of the things is that we've taken the attention that those things have given this issue, and we've really done our best to speak out about this and engage in this debate in the mainstream in a way that I know as an Asian American sort of, I guess, community leader, I've never sort of had this discussion in the mainstream. Always been happy and very glad to have it in academia, and have it, you know, in Asian American organizations, minority organizations, But now I know what it means to have this conversation in the mainstream. And it's really different. Like behind the scenes, there's all this money flowing to Asian American nonprofits in ways that they have never encountered. So this is a key moment, you know, where the whole country kind of was like, oh, you guys had these issues? And you're like, wow, you really didn't know. You really, really didn't know. And so, you know, we're out there talking to people because we want to make this known. And although our lived experience internally for us as Asian Americans, we know it all because it's our life. And we live our interior lives as well as our lives in the mainstream. But our issues have never sort of like been at the forefront of these discussions. And now they are. And so at the same time that we're doing this, you know, we're sensitive. The way I talk about it is that Me Too, BLM, and the anti-Asian hate movement, they're all the same. They're all linked together by sort of systems of oppression. And we're all going against sort of like oppression on the basis of gender, on the basis of race, which included African Americans and Asian Americans, that we're different. Everyone experiences it differently, but there are many commonalities, which is why we need to focus on those commonalities to break the ultimate sort of, you know, enemy, which is the system, the structural racism. You know, and so that's part of the public education campaign that we're doing. You know, part of it is having, you know, collaboration among minority groups. It's not easy. It has to start with your own life in a very real way. You have to start like in yourself, because you can't just be like, let's go out and get some friends I didn't have before. You know, like it's going to take some time. But I think if you start now, then it'll be working out later. You know, for myself, it's not like I have a ton of friends that are different from me. Most of my friends are like me. They're either Chinese, Korean, or East Asian. You know, but because of my work at the EEOC, and most of my mentors have been African American, you know, I've been lucky to have them as my mentors, but they've also given me a lot of, you know, support to work in. Hold on.
No worries.
Sorry. Yes. So legislative reforms is something that is a little bit more long term. You know, people are talking about changes in hate crimes. We haven't seen actually any proposals yet. I'm not quite sure if we need them, you know, to be honest, but I think that we still should talk about them, but that's a more longer term project. You know, right now what we're doing is that we're talking to DAs, and we're talking to DAs across the city. Because, you know, as you might know or might not know, there's a lot of gray area in which a DA can exercise discretion. And within that gray area, there's a dearth of knowledge about Asian Americans and how Asian Americans and racism operates. We saw that very specifically within the Atlanta shootings, where the Asian American women were written out, described as, you know, sort of objects of lust, which needed to be eliminated. Which was really, I think, you know, shocking to us, because we, I think, understood in the Asian American community immediately what that was about. But it was hidden by sort of gendered, it was very specific about Asian American women in a very complex way that erased them from that narrative. And so part of the public education campaign is to say, we got to come out and tell you how that's not okay. And we need to do that education often and loud. The last thing is that civil actions is that we don't only want people to be held accountable by going to jail and getting records. In instances where people are not hurting people, like there's not serious injury and, you know, or the like, we think that mediation, conflict resolution, restorative justice principles, where they go through training, anger management, that should be part of the solution. You know, and so we think that there is a lot of room for that within sort of the solution set that we want to bring. So,
great.
Yeah.
So let me just stop sharing, because I think one of the reasons we wanted to have this presentation and engage directly with the audience is because a lot of this is about dialogue and not just talking at you, but talking with you.
Let me just start off with a few questions. President Biden has recently come out with executive action discussing sort of the anti-Asian hate that's been going on in the country. He has so far, I believe, 3 times in his speeches mentioned anti-Asian hate and how it's un-American. Most recently on Tuesday, he released a bunch of directives. Some of them include funding for domestic violence and sexual assault in the AAPI community. National Science Foundation funds about $33 million to study bias and xenophobia, resurrecting or not resurrecting, but giving more push to the White House initiative on Asian American and Pacific Islanders, which sort of languished under the previous administration, but was very much supported during the Obama administration, as well as other initiatives in the Department of Justice in regards to sort of how hate crimes are handled. And also a new sort of training within the FBI in terms of how data is collected for Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders. One particular issue that came up during the congressional hearing that was held a couple of weeks ago was one of the speakers, Daniel Dae Kim, the actor, he talked about how a pollster said that we were statistically insignificant. And, you know, that meant that we didn't matter. So I think the Bar Association, other organizations like Stop AAPI Hate, AAPI Data, you know, Asian American Federation, et cetera, with, you know, collecting this data in order to make us significant. We'll start with the gentleman named Tai Chi, who is actually not named Tai Chi. His name is Russell Leung. He's our editor of CUNY Forum. So Chris is familiar with Russell. So we'll allow him to talk.
Russell.
Oh, yes. Jake. Chris, Karen,
hey,
how's everybody? I don't think I could unmute this picture, but anyway, I wanted to, you know, thank you for this kind of timely talk. And I had a question. I'm just going to be a devil's advocate, especially in terms of the what Chris was talking about Black-Asian relations. A Korean-American sociologist, Kayong Park, recently put out a book called Rising LA. It's sort of a retrospective look at the LA riots. And one of her theories I had never heard before, but I thought it was interesting that many African-Americans believe in kind of a theory of being here prior, that they have been in America prior to other groups such as Asians. Of course, they're not, you know, really including Native Americans. But and so basically, if you were here prior, then, you know, and your needs and your should take priority, and that Asian Americans are the newest kid on the block in a way. And even though, of course, if you look at work by Erica Lee or Evelyn Udi Hart, obviously, you know, Asians have been, you know, in the Americas for a very, very long time. But nonetheless, I think that Kayong has a interesting, you know, idea. So that basically, you know, looking at this whole relationship in terms of priority and power and so forth. And so therefore, if Asians are so-called the last kid on the block, then why are we focusing so much attention on their needs, whether they get beat up or whether they need, you know, better housing or whatever. So I'm just, you know, throwing this out as a devil's advocate because, you know, it kind of bothered me, but I don't have the answer. So I thought that, you know, you might have some ideas about this. Thank you.
Thanks, Russell. Always great to talk with you. And I think that nativism, you know, is coming out of deep pain in the African American community, you know, both out of the legacy of slavery and the feeling that, you know, the new kids on the block, the post 65 immigrants, many of whom were Asian Americans, you know, succeeded and took the fruits of the civil rights movement and of America, and then weren't grateful to African Americans in a way that I think they deserve to be. And, you know, they're right that Asian Americans are not grateful to African Americans as a whole. You know, like most immigrants who came to this country hear a mythology of this country before they get here, which is that America's the greatest country in the world. Your country is like, you know, blank, not so great. We're going to let you in. So this is who you're grateful to. And when you come here, you'll become American by looking down on sort of African Americans because they're messed up. And there's a lot of truth to that mythology that people sort of either explicitly or implicitly take in. And so I think that although I want to reject the nativism, I want to sort of be empathetic and see the heart of that like feeling, right? Within Chinese Americans and Asian Americans, we kind of have the same parallel. Like the ABCs look down on the FOBs because they're like, FOBs, you just got to get rid of your accents. You got to learn how to be American and then you'll get promoted and do all these things, right? And so even within sort of Chinese American communities, there's a sort of like degree of nativism. I think we have to recognize that nativism is really like toxic, you know, both within our communities. I think that there is that nativism within African Americans because they've been here for so long. So just because they've faced racism doesn't mean they can't be nativist. But at the same time, and this is my personal experience, like I've experienced African Americans extending a hand to me when I had no one else helping me, you know, and that was because they understood sort of that, like when they were down and no one was helping them, they kind of had to really drag themselves by their own boots or no boots. And so I think that, you know, and I know that that's a huge element in the African-American population as well, because I've experienced that like on multiple levels, multiple times. So I think that there is a lot of truth to that sort of, you know, sort of finding. But I think that that's not representative of African-Americans as a whole. You know, the Saturday after the Atlanta shooting, I was in Chinatown in Manhattan, and I saw more Black people in Chinatown there than I have seen in my entire life. And they were walking around, talking to people, shopping, eating. And I didn't quite sort of take it all in until like I got back home. And I was like, oh, they're showing up just to say hi and to like say, we got your back, you know? And so I think that's really strong too. I think that's really there. I think it's really hard to measure. But these things are really, really complex. And I think that in order to be an engaged citizen and to be in this particular time, we have to show an understanding of history along with like an empathetic understanding of where they're coming from. Sorry if that went really long, Russell, but.
No. I agree with you. Actually, I was in San Francisco Chinatown a week ago, and I did notice, more African Americans. They had closed some of the streets in order to help some of the businesses. And, you know, there were quite a few African American families and other individuals there for shopping and so forth. I think probably to show support also because, you know, there were many rallies going on at the same time. I thank both of you for your, putting the report out and also asking the tough questions and, you know,
I mean, I think that's really awesome that you saw that in San Francisco too, you know, because in one way, the African-American community, I think, is also wondering because they're seeing the videos, they're seeing that narrative, right. You know, and they're kind of like, they're like, what's going on? You know, and quite honestly, the Atlanta shooting was a white like perpetrator. So there was like a feeling like we can come out and show support now without them being too angry. Do you know what I mean? Like, that's literally like sort of like we're going to come out and show support. We've been wanting to, but we don't know if it'll be received. You know what I mean? And so, yeah, it's really complex. A lot of it is not said, but I think we need to say it now in this time so that we begin to have these conversations. The moments in our social society are not that often to have these conversations. But I want to actually, Russell, I want to ask you a question later. I want to move on to let other people have a question, but I have an important question for you.
Okay.
Relating to the Asian American movement in 68, 69, because I feel like right now we're in another sort of epoch-making moment where I think there's another opportunity to make some of the changes.
Okay, well, why don't we talk about it later? Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, so we'll get back to Russell later on. Mr. Zhong Chen.
I have a question regarding the perpetrators who may have been African American. What is the speaker's opinion in that regard, in which African Americans who may be sympathetic to the Black Lives Movement, but they're oblivious to the attacks against Asians? And what is the greater narrative that perhaps Asian American leaders can speak to that. I don't really see anything in the media, and I'm just curious of, I know Chris said something before, but I'm interested in hearing how we can come in unity with Black Lives Matters movement.
Yeah, there's definitely a conflict in those two ideas, right? Where you do want to support sort of reform to the justice system, but you know, we also want to have great respect for the victims and the victims' rights and justice for some of these horrific acts. I mean, I think first and foremost, we are, you know, supporting victims of any race who have suffered, you know, crimes and been hurt by hate incidents. And I don't think that means that you can't also think that the criminal justice system requires some reform, and that you know, perpetrators of all colors need to be respected in terms of getting their equal rights and fairness within the criminal justice system. But you know, for Asian leaders, I mean, I do think our message has been obviously to make sure that the victims are respected and that their rights are vindicated and that there is justice for them, which is why the lack of prosecution and or just the lack of charging hate crimes for incidents that might warrant that label, that branding, and the sort of more severe penalties that come with it is an extreme problem. And I don't think, as Chris mentioned, the solution is to say that we need to defund the police or not work with the police to fix these things, because there are two sides to the coin of justice, that it's, you know, it is respect for everyone being treated equally within the system, but it is also, of course, protecting the community and making sure that victims' rights are respected.
You know, Asian American leaders, you know, need to talk about every issue that matters to the community. And, you know, like Karen said, we don't care who is, like, you know, if someone's hurt seriously or killed, like, it doesn't matter who they are, like, race-wise, like, they need to be held accountable, right? And that's the first and foremost. And then I think aside from that, you know, is, you know, what is the issue between African Americans and Asian Americans? We look at the LA riots, we look at the flashpoints, right? But then, you know, on the other side of the coin, one of the things that I, you know, talk about is know your history in this country. When the Chinese first came in large numbers to America, they were not allowed to be citizens by law. You know, we were not eligible. We were aliens ineligible for citizenship. We were despised. We were told you will not be accepted as Americans. You cannot become American. The only way that we found out around it was birthright citizenship, one can mark, right? You know, but that was based on the 14th Amendment, right? And the 14th Amendment was passed because, not for us, but for African Americans, and the question of how freed slaves and their children, would they be Americans? So that was in the Constitution for African Americans. And then we got to ride along on that right. And then when the Chinese Exclusion Act came, and then the Chinese immigrants stopped, the Japanese came, and they were able to ride on that right. And when they had children, and you could not hold property if you were not citizens, but the Japanese held property in their children's name. And then they were able to have all these rights. And so if we're able to understand the linkage between the African-American freedom struggle, which came out of, you know, the Civil War, and America had to fight a civil war to end slavery, and then the freedoms that came there, we got to ride on that a little bit. You know, that was the first Reconstruction. If we go back 100 years later to the second Reconstruction, or the Civil Rights Movement, you know, the Civil Rights Movement and the Black Power movements inspired the Asian American movement, which created the term Asian American out of self-control, self-identification. No more Orientals. You don't get to name us. We get to define ourselves. So we got a bit of sort of like, you know, consciousness, political freedoms, self-worth out of that, because we had been relegated to non-professional roles, you know, not to expect too much from American society, not what white families would get, you know. So I think if we understand sort of Asian Americans in relation to the freedom struggle of African Americans from the first Reconstruction to the second, And now I think to the third, you know, we're reconstructing our society in a way that's going to make it fair for everyone. And we have to remember sort of the major freedom struggles and how we can ride along and how we can contribute and how we can build. I think that we need to talk to the African-American community about why there are for a community that has suffered so much in this country, why there are perpetrators, there are African-American. We need to understand the tensions. And then I think we would get to a point where like, this is stupid to fight each other because we're distracting from the major fight. The major fight is to change institutions and the law in America so that everybody can have a fair society. And so that's kind of the long range answer, you know, that's been given. Jung, I don't know if that satisfies sort of your concern that you raised.
I'm familiar with Wong Kim Ark and everything that you said. So, you know, I'm afraid when I speak to Gen Xers, I'm a baby boomer. So, you know, our own Asian Americans have this model minority myth that I think Aru Vanderpoel recently came out with a book that, you know, the laws benefited during the civil rights movement, certainly the Immigration Naturalization Act that President Johnson signed really benefited South Asians.
All Asian. Yeah. All Asian. East Asian. South Asian. Okay. Right.
Yeah. But I just think that we need someone like a Martin Luther King or perhaps Al Sharpton to bring into this fold where we're speaking to other minorities that, you know, we has suffered just as much as they did and was oppressed, you know, that women were not allowed through the Asian Exclusion Acts to come into this country and they were not allowed to have different, you know, mixed marriages and so on. So, but you answer my point. Another thing I just wanted to make, I'm not sure if it's a question or an issue, but at least Democratic leaders haven't really explained this. I'm a New York State affordable housing civil servant, and I actually put in my retirement papers the other day, but
congratulations.
thank you. So, you know, I'm sure everyone here at this forum knows that America has the most incarcerated in the developed world. You know, I personally am not against defunding police, but it's understood in the affordable housing realm, which is taking people out who are formerly incarcerated and giving them services to make them productive citizens as post incarceration. You know, I think that the narrative should be that that we should provide those services, and that's where I think that the Democratic Party has kind of muddled the waters in terms of defunding the police. So I just wanted to push that point out. I'm curious of your perspective, but I think that should be explained because it was studied under some of the Trump voters that they misunderstood that point and they supported Trump. So anyway, that's
the only thing. I mean, the coronavirus, as it has gone around the world, has been a stress test for the social welfare net of any country. And what it has shown us in this country that we call home is that there's no real social safety welfare net. We're a rough country. You know, we fought about the extension of the unemployment insurance. You know, we paid people more, you know, than they earned. We saved people a little bit for like 6 months into it. I'm all for having an extensive social welfare net because that's going to take care of some of the conflicts that are rising to the surface because we are all stressed. Everybody's like at a breaking point. Many of us are lucky. We work at home. We're professionals. We don't suffer the stress. but the people who are in the front lines. I'm not talking just about the healthcare, but the people who are bringing our food, the people who have to show up to work. If you notice, the people who are bringing your food are immigrants, Black and Latinos, for the most part, right? You know, and, you know, they're in the front lines too. Like, let's not forget about them, you know? And so I think that we need to have a conversation about extensive social safety welfare nets, about making this a more fair society, because otherwise we're just going to be at each other's throat, so.
Okay, thank you very much, John, for your question. Let's see. There was a question in the chat box in regards to whether or not we, ARI, or other, you know, individuals were able to do something in regards to safety walking, taking people from home to the subway, etc. Just to answer that, in Chinatown, there's actually two organizations, groups, volunteers, Safe Walks NYC, as well as Protect Chinatown. These are made up of volunteers who take any individual, if you contact them via their website, I believe, and Instagram and QR code, etc., to set up the appointment to bring you either home, to your workplace, to the subway, to public transportation. And Safe Walks NYC is actually spearheaded by an African American who started the program in Brooklyn. And after the attacks started rising in Chinatown, decided to come out to Chinatown and with his other volunteers, including Asian Americans, came together and, you know, started to do the walks over there. So there's that. Chris and Karen, so let me ask a question. In regards to hate crimes, there's this feeling that these attacks towards Asian Americans aren't being labeled as hate crimes or being prosecuted as hate crimes. Could you sort of just go into the nitty gritty about what, why is it so hard to prosecute a crime as a hate crime?
I guess I'll start, and then I think Chris has some thoughts to share from his conversations with the DA's office and the like. But the hate crime statute is written in a way that requires an element of intent. So you have to prove that the perpetrator had racial animus when they, or racial intent to harm because of race or ethnicity when they committed the crime. So because you have this mental state requirement, it's very hard to prove unless the perpetrator says something in the act of committing the crime and it's recorded, or you have a witness that can testify to it. And so it's hard to prove what someone was thinking about when they committed the crime unless they make a statement and confess it. And so that's why there's sometimes a reluctance to really pursue it. And when the crime is, you know, one of physical aggression or assault, we've heard from various, you know, police that they're pursuing it. They're just going to charge them with the regular assault. It's not like the person's getting away. They're just not going to go forward with the hate crime element. But this can be extremely, you know, frustrating, of course, because the hate element of it is really, you know, what we're seeing arise to during this pandemic. And it's important to recognize that something is a hate crime for, you know, community justice and trying to put the right crime, right label on the crime. And there are also more severe penalties when something is considered or prosecuted as a hate crime. And so, unfortunately, what we've been hearing a lot from the police and the prosecutors is that there just isn't enough evidence and, you know, we'll just go forward with a regular crime. And they aren't really giving enough weight, in my opinion, to some of the context. So knowing that this is in the middle of a global pandemic and, you know, it's just not a coincidence that the victim is Asian. And you can do more investigation, look at the history of social media posts by the perpetrator or whatever other context is available, at least try and at least consider the possibility that it was a hate crime and characterize it as such, as a possible hate crime when it's being discussed with the media, so that it's not just dismissed, you know, almost out of sort of lack of desire to make your life and work harder, that people should actually go the extra mile to go and see if there is a ground for it. So that's really, the statute is written in a way that it's difficult to prove. And then the reaction is, well, what do you do in that circumstance? Do you try? Do you think about things? Do you look at the context of the situation? And either we change the statute or we change the approach of the police and the prosecutors in response to the statute. And I know Chris has had a lot of conversations with DAs and some aggravating situations where there was evidence and they're still not pursuing it. So let me turn it over to Chris.
Yeah, thanks, Karen. You know, part of the problem begins with the racial hierarchy that we exist in America, whether you know it or not, whether you agree with it or not. And part of the model minority issue is that Asian Americans are perceived as honorary whites. Okay. So, you know, basically, you know, when things are good, you know, white people see us, we're basically white, you know, and blacks see us as honorary whites as well. You know, they go, well, you're not, you know, you're not black, that's for sure, but you're pretty much white, you know, because it operating in large part due to the model minority myth, this perception that Asian Americans are professionals, that they earn a lot of money, and they're basically white people. So if you take that sort of racial hierarchy as an overlay, and then you get into this era, and all of a sudden mainstream media is like, Asians experience discrimination, dang, we didn't know, tell us about it, you know? And then you get to the DAs and things are happening. They're like, everyone's saying it's hate crimes. I guess so. Maybe. Probably not. You know, like, you know, prototype situations. If you understand African-American, if you understand American history, you understand when a noose is placed on an African-American's locker or chair, that's a hate crime because it's hearkening back to deep stories that exist within the American sort of like psyche. Jewish people have also done a great job of telling people their story. Hey, if there's a swastika, or if there is, you know, sort of David that's desecrated, or if someone's walking the temple and they get attacked, that's anti-Semitism. And they've told their story. Asian Americans have not told their story. And so we end up almost at a default situation where we have to prove it, right? So, you know, you go to Atlanta and it's like, make no mistake, the police were explicitly pushing this is not racial. Why? Because they're like, we had to deal with BLM in the summer. Don't let the Asians get in line for this. That seriously is like a narrative that's floating in. Like, don't let the Asians get up and be like, that's discrimination too. We're going to tell you really from the beginning, it's not. What is it about? Well, you're just such a temptation. Like, you know, it's your fault, really. Like, that's what that is, right? It's your fault. You make yourself a temptation, you know? So we are starting at a default. We have to prove it. We're not like, yo, we got attacked. Can you just see it for what it is? No, we're starting from zero. We're starting from negative. And so, you know, I'll bring everyone back to the Flushing Bakery attack. Everybody, you know, might remember it. They're standing in line in a bakery. They get into an argument. He pushes her. She hits a newsstand, you know, sort of thing, 10 stitches on her forehead. He gets charged with third degree assault. That's a misdemeanor. Okay. That's in downtown Flushing. Okay. 26% Asian American in Queens. So it's not even a second degree assault, even though there's a disfiguring scar on her face. And then after he gets charged, he talks to the New York Times, February 26th article. Okay. If you want to look for it. And he says, well, what happened wasn't, I'm sure he thought it wasn't racial because he's like, what I said to her was, this is not China. Give me space. It's coronavirus. I mean, he says that to the New York Times. This is a couple of weeks after he's charged. Today is what? April 2nd? Nothing has changed from the Queens DA after they saw that in the New York Times. Okay? Nothing has changed. Why? Because they either don't get it, they either don't care, or it just doesn't matter to them. Now, the Queens DA has been relentless in going to every single forum to tell the Asian American community at least two things. One, we really, really take this seriously. And number two, we really, really care. And here I am. But what I've said to them, you know, is can we see your actions, but not what you say? Because they're so used to showing up to Asian American communities. And then Asian American communities are like, let's take a picture and that's enough. You know, and we have to say, not enough, not anymore. That's BS. We want to see real action. We don't want to see everything be a hate crime. We want to see some things that are clearly kind of calling for it, that are able to be made that, to be done so. But the system is not used to us making a stink. The system is not used to us making a point of things. and the system is just getting used to serving how Asian Americans and race operate under the hate crimes law, particularly if they have a background where they believe that Asian Americans are basically white people, which means that we have not experienced discrimination and don't.
Well, speaking of the Queens DA, actually coming up on the 7th, they have an online forum available online, and the title of it is Combating Anti-Asian Hate Crimes. So hopefully DA Katz will have some sort of updated information for those of you who do register for that event and ask it during the Q&A. I mean, in terms of hate crimes, also there was the incident in nearby Chinatown on Wharf Street. An individual was stabbed with an 8-inch knife, and his reasoning was, I didn't like the way the individual looked at me. And then later on, he charged down the street and plunged it into him and ran away. And that wasn't charged with a hate crime. Certain individuals, community members, came out in uproar against that, the decision by the Manhattan DA, as you explained later on, earlier on. No hate crime charges over there too. And, you know, people are upset about that.
They are. You know, that decision, Karen, I didn't know if you wanted to speak to that before I sort of
get. No, go ahead.
You know, that decision is a little bit more defensible. The Manhattan DA said, person's face is covered, it's dark, the attacker is coming from behind, we don't think he ever saw his face. Now, that doesn't mean it's over, because you don't necessarily have to be like, hey, you blah, 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 chink or whatever. Like, you know, if it happened in Chinatown, there's all sorts of stuff that you could take into account. Like, we don't know if the attacker had attacked other Asians. That would be good evidence, right? You know, he was basically in Chinatown. I mean, anyone who's, you know, Asian has been on that street corner, right? Particularly for us, because we're coming from the court to Chinatown. I'm like, I was just on that street corner like the week before. Like, that could have been me. That person almost died. You know, they thought he was going to die. So that hit very close to home and just had a baby, right? And so, look, if it's not a hate crime, we at the very least want these matters taken very seriously in these times. And quite honestly, the Atlanta murders, I'll tell you, before the Atlanta murders, the police and the DAs were like, it's mostly spitting, it's harassment. It's just, you know, like, people are not dying. Like, you had that grandfather in California all the way out there, right? But people weren't, like, they literally were not taking it seriously. You know, all these things, 4,000 incidents nationwide, most of them happening in California and New York, all these spitting, shunning, people, you know, experiencing humiliating acts which destroy their sense of security and their sense of community and feeling like they're part of the fabric of New York. That's serious. But what they are is they show you where this country is building up to, where they exploded in the spasm of violence. And by the police letting these little things go, they allow these things eventually in another part of the country to explode into, you know, violence. And that's why we take those things seriously. That's why we say those things need to be taken care of seriously. Those things need to be addressed. And it's very difficult for us to get out there, but we are, you know, emboldened, I think, now, you know, particularly the community is galvanized internally within the Asian American community and beyond. And, you know, this is a really, you know, important moment. And Russell, I don't know if it's a good time to return to it, you know, as someone who is our elder, you know, and who was there, if not at there or near the beginning of the, you know, Asian American movement in the late 60s and early 70s, you know, I feel like we're in another sort of, you know, similarly historic moment, and that, you know, we have an opportunity to make historic change. Do you feel the same way, Russell?
We'll bring Russell back right after I answer two comments in the Q&A box. One, yep. Zhang Chen asked, what about the Asian man who was chokehold and fainted in the subway? Now, regarding that, Mr. Chen, that individual may or may not be Asian, according to the current news reports and the person who actually took the video. So that's still being investigated. But of course, it's a crime nonetheless. It has to be reported, investigated, and we'll see what happens out of that. Another comment is, why is it that all of a sudden after the previous guy in office left, after all his rhetoric with, you know, China
virus, you shall not be named now. It's a new Voldemort.
Yes. Why is it all of a sudden, out of nowhere, like a volcano, all of these crimes are happening? against Asians. Like, all this, why didn't happen much more during his time in office, you know, during 2020 as your...
Yeah, I don't know that it's necessarily fair to say that it's only started after he left, because I think he is one of the root causes for this anti-Asian sentiment. I mean, when he was in office, he called it the China virus. He made all sorts of derogatory remarks. It was picked up by other politicians in his party. And I think the tensions. So it's the health crisis. It's the economic, you know, downturn because of the health crisis. It's also the international sort of gamesmanship that was happening under that administration between the US and China, and kind of, you know, trying to find an enemy and building this narrative of this is enemy country out there, kind of a Cold War style, you know, other versus us, that I think made huge, huge, you know, impact on the sort of hate and bias that only just continued to fester as the situation became worse. So I think he is very much a root cause and, you know, one of the starting points of this. And it is not his departure that has caused this.
Sure. And one more thing before Russell talks about the movement.
Let me get in sort of my two cents there is that, you know, South Asians, you know, suffered great sort of persecution after 9/11, and then all through Trump's first presidency in the Muslim ban. And then when Trump began using, I mean, let's be clear about this. The U.S.-China geopolitical framework and its worsening position is at the root of this, and that the anti-China sort of like geopolitical-wise sentiment is really affecting Asian Americans. And that's at the root of it. And when Trump called it the China virus, it was the match that lit the fire. But we were all home. We were all home for like 5 or 6 months. And then we were BLM. The media focus was really BLM. And then it quieted down by the end of the year. And just remember, we're in the Derek Chauvin Trump. So the BLM is still here. While we're talking about anti-Asian hate, we've also gotta keep an eye on that. It's related. We have to keep that in mind. So as we talk about it, we don't sort of forget our place in history. Sorry, Anthony.
Yeah. Sure. Before Russell begins, just in terms of narratives, just so people know, last year, 2020, PBS came out with a documentary, 5-part docuseries called Asian Americans. It's available online right now to view, in case any of you didn't have a chance to view it during Asian Pacific Heritage Month last May 2020. It's available online. There are classroom lesson plans available. It was done through the Asian American Advancing Justice Center, who worked together with PBS and WIDA, who funded the program. And if any of you are teachers, fourth grade to 12th grade, as well as college educators who want to sort of integrate some of this Asian American history information into your classroom lesson plans, now more than ever, you can go online. It's available for free, a free resource for you. Other resources are available on our website, as you know, all the narratives that Chris has talked about in terms of Wong Ah Kim, 9/11, what happened to South Asians afterwards, all covered by the documentary series. Of course, our history can't just be told in five one-hour, you know, parts, but please do your research on our history and the history of other individuals. So, Russell, you want to chime in? Russell was recently quoted in the USA Today regarding this particular question in terms of the movement. So,
I didn't know that. So I'm you know.
No, but actually, Chris, because I think your question is a little bit more, it's more tangential to this particular forum. So I think maybe we can save that and we can do a dialogue for the CUNY forum, you know what I mean? About Asian American studies and so forth. And the moment, but I actually had a question to both you and Karen. You know, after the Atlanta murders, a number of Asian American commentators and other people said that it was the intersection of misogyny and race. And in just during this forum, when you were talking about the whole dynamics of, you know, what was happening, it seemed to me that a lot of the dynamics is quite similar to how women who have been sexually harassed have had to basically always be on the defensive. They had to prove, they had to bear the burden of proof. The gatekeepers were, you know, basically guys. And, you know, it's still a struggle. I mean, you know, whether you're talking about the Brett Kavanaugh thing or, you know, even going back to Anita Hill, I mean, just, you know, there's dozens and hundreds of cases. So, I mean, do Asians have to, like women, like, you know, women have to bear the burden of proof and show intent? Because it seems like it's almost the dynamics, it's almost exactly the same as for women in these cases. So I was just curious what your take was.
Well, yes, I mean, I definitely do see it as an intersection, and not even just, you know, identity is a very complex thing, right? So it's, for me at least, it's hard to separate gender and race. I mean, I'm an Asian woman and I have a particular experience as a result of that in a particular perspective. And the comments, to say that the comments that were made around the Atlanta murders was trying to divorce race from, you know, from the dialogue. I mean, it's just absurd to me that there isn't racial element to the way people were trying to portray that situation as sort of just a sexual thing or kind of a desire, object of desire thing. I think it's so clearly both a race and a gender issue, and very ingrained in Asian women sort of stereotypes. And so I don't know, that's sort of how I see that issue, and it sort of seems absurd to me. Chris, do you have a separate?
Yeah, no, I'm just taking that in, Russell, and I think you're absolutely right. You know, in Edward Said's Orientalism, you have the feminization of, like, you know, the East, right? So you have, you know, sort of that same sort of dynamic here. And what is that about? It's like power, right? You know, whenever one people create a system, that system's logic, you know, perpetrates the ideas and the logic of the person who created the system. As lawyers, Karen and I know that, like, simple neutral rules can really affect how things turn out. You might not even have a claim if you're not timely. You know, who has the burden of proof can be determinative in terms of who is able to prove their case and what cases are actually brought or defended, right? And so we enter into systems and we don't know how things are, like, designed, you know, because a lot of those things are invisible to us, you know? And so I think that, you know, what you're putting your finger on and that we're putting our finger on as we're thinking through this is the designs of the systems and the normalizations and the defaults and what is considered is or normal, right? You know, who gets to be human within this system that we're living in? You know, who gets to, like, have their voice heard? I think one of the greatest victories of the civil rights movement and African-American struggles was to be like, racism exists and it's wrong. You know, like, it's so crazy when we look back on the times now, we're like, yeah, you know, and we think about George Floyd. If we had video during slavery, maybe it would have ended, like, so much earlier, because we were like, we had undeniable proof of the brutality of the system that still exists. I think that's what we saw with George Floyd, with that video. We were all touched to our core and angry, because we know, but then to watch that, like, carried out, you know, we're like, oh my God, you know, and we were all moved, and we should be moved, you know. So we might have arguments with BLM here and there without, but its central focus is to, like, get rid of these injustices that have been at the heart of the American system. And Asian Americans have ridden on those progresses. We should be grateful and we should help. And we should also, you know, not just defer. I think we should be partners, like really strong partners, because we're going to have points of disagreement. And I've worked on points of disagreement with things, you know, where I've had to be like, hey, with the SAT, the specialized high school, I disagree. And this is why. And I think I'm disagreeing in a principled, non-racist way. But those have been really difficult, nuanced conversations to have. But we need more Asian Americans to be in that space, to take up that space, because we've been too focused on our lives, on being successful, taking care of our parents, which we should, right. You know.
And playing within the rules, you know, as right. opposed to challenging the rules.
That's right. That's right. So we've benefited, you know, but we should also shake things up a little bit to say, hey, what are the injustices that we should look at?
Well, just impartial, I'm going to be short, impartial answer to your question about, you know, this is the moment. I think one very hopeful sign, and it's not just happening now, the development of, critical race studies. And, many African-American, Latino, and Asian-American scholars, from Kimberly Crenshaw and African-American to people like Jerry Kang, Eric Yamamoto, who talks about how the redress for Japanese-Americans perhaps can be a model for a certain type of reparations for African-Americans. And, his ideas have been used. So I think that the last 20 years, especially in the critical race studies field, is a place in which at least four groups, African-Americans, Asian-Americans, Latinos, and women have kind of worked together to try to look at the underpinnings and the premises of how, the precedence of legal cases and so forth. So I think, we can actually build upon some of the initiatives of critical race studies, which is basically critical activists, and it basically brings together, I think, many things that we are talking about.
And Russell, that those are my teachers at law school. So,
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, all right. You see how
I am. So there you go. Those things, I think, are bearing fruit. They're under attack, right? So we need to tell the truth about them. It's not there's things to be criticized, I think, but they have informed sort of my view and how we've gone about it. And so, so looking forward to our next program, right, Anthony? We're going to do with Russell, the new Asian American movement, right?
Got it. Okay, so we'll move on to our next question. But before I allow him to talk, he typed it into the Q&A box. He wrote, does the panel have a detailed breakdown of the facts concerning these thousands of racist incidents that happened so far? Who did it and what were the gradations of these events? So I'll allow him to talk and then he'll elaborate some more. Mr. Dingaman?
Yes.
Yes, please ask your question.
Yes, thank you. Yes, I'm referring to the numbers that have been cited. And I have to say that I've watched these events happen ever since the pandemic began. And what I've noticed, at least in New York City, is that most of the events that I've seen have been non-whites making racist comments to Asian Americans. I've seen that from the start. So I wondered what the panel had to say about that. I know that we're talking about a wider swath of issues throughout the country, but that's what I've seen concretely in the neighborhoods that I've lived in and on the subways. I've seen joking comments made early in the pandemic, like it's your fault. And then I actually saw Chinese food restaurants that I would go to shut down because they were afraid of the kind of comments being made. So I just wanted to address that. What do you think? I missed the beginning of your talk and how you discussed that, but how do you understand that aspect of what's going on here?
Chris and Karen, before you begin, Mr. Dingaman, we're recording this talk, so it'll be available on our website Monday afternoon, so you could actually watch the first part of it. Right before the speakers give their answer, I just want to share my story. Earlier on, before the mask mandate was given for New York City, I actually got on Canal Street, right, located in Chinatown, rode the 6. I got into a car, a subway car, and then I had a mask on. And a white female and her African-American friend were the only two people in the train car with me. And the white lady started coughing. And then she verbally said, "Oh, I'm going to start coughing right now." So then I looked at her and then I said, "Well, yeah, real funny, right?" And then later on, I decided to move to another train car before it got to the next station because I didn't know what she had or not. This was earlier on during the pandemic, CDC, et cetera. White House COVID task force didn't know what they were going to, do, no mask, yes mask, et cetera. Asian American community, of course, earlier on, because, they're familiar with sort of the diseases back in Asia in terms of SARS, et cetera. They knew, the mask would, protect them somewhat. So I decided to move to another car. So then after I moved to another car, the lady right before, the door shut, she said, "You don't have to wear a mask unless you're sick." That's what she said to me. And that particular incident, I reported it to, you know, Stop AAPI Hate, because at the time, you know, there was no other sort of repository, you know, to put my particular experience in. I wrote about it inside my my contribution to CUNY Forum Volume 8. And, you know, I have a photo essay about sort of the Asian American Chinatown community, how I experienced sort of pause during those particular months before we reopened up in June. So that's just my piece. So Karen and Chris.
Well, I will note that, and Jim probably missed the beginning of this, but in the report that Chris and I worked on, we did try to gather the statistics that were available through a variety of organizations and nonprofits that were collecting the data. For the most part, they do focus on the types of incidents and where the incidents are being reported. You know, but by state, by city, and sort of general location, if it's public transportation, for example, it doesn't focus. We didn't find a lot of data on the descriptions of the perpetrators. You do get that information when you look at the police statistics, but as we discussed, there's a lot of underreporting to the actual police themselves and not a lot of prosecutions. I mean, I agree that in New York City, just given the demographics of the city, public transportation, and, you know, the demographics of people who are able to stay at home to work and people who have to travel through public transportation, that there is, I think, more reporting of minority groups, you know, attacking other minority groups. But I'm not sure that that is necessarily reflective of, you know, the problem across the country. Or the sort of sentiment that's being shared across the country just because of the way the city is designed and some of the biases in the reporting. So anyway, let me turn to Chris in case he knows of additional information.
I mean, I think we addressed it at length in the beginning, so definitely, you know, look for it in the beginning of the program.
Okay, so Mr. Bingman, please check out our video on Monday. We have a few more minutes left in case any other individuals who are joining us would like to make a comment. Maybe you experienced some sort of harassment. You just want to let it out. Please raise your hand and we'll take a listen. Hi, Ms. Steele, you're on.
Hi, yeah. Thank you so much for putting this webinar together. I've been attending quite a few, and this is one of the best ones I've heard so far. But yeah, no, it's necessarily not, you know, a particular demographic group who are attacking. I am in the Upper East Side in the 80s, and most of my verbal and physical attacks were upper middle class white men and women in their 50s and 60s. So I can say from my own personal experience that, you know, it's not, you know, we can't say it's, you know, the Black or Hispanic or the working class people who are doing the attacking. A couple of questions that came up with friends who had to go get their first or second vaccination shots. They're afraid to leave the home. And I myself had to take a $52 Uber ride to the Bronx Science High School to get my second shot. And is there, and people are wondering if there is a service or escort or volunteers who would help, especially the elders going out to get groceries, to the bank, running errands, getting their vaccine shots. Any number or a website we can visit?
In regards to escort, we sort of mentioned that earlier. There's a group called Safe Walks NYC. Perhaps you can just contact them in order to find out whether or not they go all the way above Manhattan, sort of the upper parts. In terms of grocery shopping, earlier on in the pandemic, there was a volunteer group called Invisible Hands. They were actually helping seniors deliver their food to groceries to their homes. Yeah. And then in terms of vaccination appointments, taking people there. That I don't know about. Perhaps Safe Walks NYC can help with that. But just so you know, tomorrow in Chinatown, Chatham Square / Kim Lao Square, as it's known as also, from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m., several groups, including the Chinatown Partnership, are helping individuals 50 and above, sign up for vaccination appointments. So if you still haven't been vaccinated yet, and having trouble making appointments, you can show up in Chinatown and there will be volunteer individuals to help you.
Yeah, thank you so much. And one more quick question. A lot of my friends are asking what to do when they are verbally attacked. So I myself, for example, I'm a Jewish Korean American from Los Angeles, but people would approach and, you know, say things like, oh, there's a woman from China. If you go to China, you'll see a lot of people like her. And, oh, but you're one of the prettier China girls. So do you, at what point do you engage or not engage or just report or not report?
I will let Chris and Karen answer that after I just make a small comment. I think you should just report it no matter how big or small it is. One big repository, as I mentioned earlier on, is Stop AAPI Hate. Mm-hmm. They're sort of doing it nationwide. And then later on, they're giving the data sort of locally to individual groups, such as, I think, the Bar Association, you got some.
Yes, we use their data too.
Asian American Federation is getting data from them. If you visit our website, under publications, CUNY Forum, under resources, you'll find different organizations doing reporting. You could either just do Stop AAPI Hate or just go down the line.
Lauren, what you experience is a crime. It's second degree harassment. And harassment, verbal harassment, on the basis of race, national origin, is a crime. And most police will not arrest people for that, but it is a crime. And we are working at Avenue on an op-ed to highlight that penal code.
Right.
To say that, yeah, because right now it's just kind of going like ignored not dealt with. You should take video because video is our great equalizer.
Yeah. Thank you. I mean, I'm also an academic, so I've been in the past year, I've been keeping documents, verbal assaults, and just testimonies from friends and colleagues, and I've done interviews with shopkeepers and restaurant owners on of all East Asian and Southeast Asian population in Flushing, Jackson Heights area, New Jersey, and 32nd Street here in Manhattan. And it's pretty scary.
These are crimes that have not been addressed. So we want to highlight that statute and we're making a push to let the NYPD know that there are things that are not being enforced. And given what's happening, and while it's still hot, we think that is worthy to push this.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, just to piggyback on that. Recently in Chinatown, Christie Street, there's a new mural that went up, Stop Asian Hate. Mm-hmm. And on the Chinatown Partnership's Instagram page, you know, a lot of people in support, comments, et cetera. One particular comment said that this is in retribution. The recent attacks was in retribution for Pearl Harbor, Vietnam, and Korea, and that more attacks would occur. I reported that particular comment to the Asian Hate Task Force, the NYPD. They said that it didn't reach the level of crime.
Yeah, that's where the confusion is. A lot of people don't report verbal assaults and attacks because unless it's followed by a physical assault, because they don't think of it as crime. And they said, this is, you know, what I tolerated for the past 40 years. So what changes now? So they're not aware of the fact that these are crimes. They're not aware of that.
Penal code 240.30.
I mean,
look for our op-ed, it's coming up.
Okay, thank you.
So no matter the degree of the crime, just report it to all the different places, and the last stop, just make sure it gets recorded by Stop AAPI Hate so that...
it's also just... Yeah, it's important for making a historical record as well, like whether or not you can parse exactly what falls into which category and which crime. It's important, I think, in this moment to have a history of it so that it's not forgotten and people can track it and for what it is. And what I think Chris was talking about, like it doesn't have to be part of the hate crime statute to still be a crime. Like a harassment when you have a racial, you know, element to it, is a crime. And of course there are murky areas or First Amendment issues with certain statements and not, but you know, for what it is. I think if it's obviously being said and with that kind of with that kind of intent, I think it's worth reporting just to make a record. That's, at a minimum.
Yeah, that has been my focus in the past year. I'm writing a paper titled "What Unreported Anti-Asian Hate Crime Looks Like," and in a recent interview, I was turning you know, talking to a journalist making specifically this point that. You know, the verbal assaults are atrocious. You know, we look at images of, you know, faces, cut faces and bruised faces and violent videos, but we don't see images of these verbal attacks, right? So people are kind of covering it up and just letting it pass.
That's right. And they're having a real effect on the social fabric.
Yes.
And feeling of safety. And that's really, really important because it's about just this country, right? It's about sort of us belonging. And that's the other part of it that a little more long-term in mm-hmm. terms of what we're discussing. But, you know, like, I mean, this beyond us, the whole social fabric of this country is being scratched and being tested. And we are at that inflection point, Asian Americans, people perceive to be at. We're getting it right away. Everybody's suffering, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think I recognize that. But of course, we're bearing the brunt as the scapegoat, essentially, you know, when people see us on the streets. And so, you know.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's see. Next up is Taylor Zhao.
Okay. I just wanted to add on to what Gloria mentioned. I think it's important that there are two restaurants in Manhattan's Chinatown, the Xi'an Famous Food and the Deluxe Supermarket, where they commented that their workers, that they allow their workers to leave work early because of harassment. So I think Xi'an Famous Food said that their workers were, I think, assaulted, and the Deluxe Supermarket said that they were being chased in the subways. So it didn't rise to the degree of an actual assault. It may not have, but that's it. It goes back to stretching that that social fabric, where people just don't feel safe. The other point I wanted to second Gloria on is, I notice a comment here and there about how it impacts low income Asian communities. They may bear the brunt because they're less vocal, but it impacts everyone. Because we've had a Judge Phyllis Chu, who was punched on her way to work. I doubt that the person on the bicycle knew that she was a judge. It meant nothing to him, either case. And the other incident earlier on during the pandemic was Tiffany. She lived in a doorman building, I think on the Upper West Side or East Side, I don't recall. She left the building with her baby girl, and a homeless person who was not mentally ill there tried to attack her child. So this idea, these people, I think people's assumptions are online are so ignorant and outrageous to think that this is only relegated to people of a certain, you know, of the working class. But when you look at the videos, I mean, everyone, all ranges, young people, college students, judges, professionals, not just the working class, they may actually, we're thinking that the numbers actually underreported because the working class are silent and they have limited English proficiency. And the ones that are reporting it are perhaps are the professional class who are more comfortable reporting these incidents. So I think Gloria, what she said is totally on point. Yes, it doesn't they're not reported because it doesn't rise to the level of an assault, but being chased after in the subway, worrying about your safety leaving work, and then having, you know, people who live in doorman buildings and judges being punched on the way to work, that tells you the scope. And I think Stop AAPI, the executive director, Christine Choi, what she said was right. This is the tip of the iceberg of what's happened. And I worry now the schools are going to open up. Have we thought about, I'm sure the parents have thought about it, what's going to happen to the kids that go back to school? Thank you.
Chris or Karen, any comments?
No, I think she's spot on.
We're working on trainings that we can give to middle school and high school. Because we're worried about bullying, just like you are. Kids are susceptible to larger political overarching messages, and we want to get that out there, which is so important for Asian American studies to be taught here. And, you know, I want to just go back to CUNY Ari's statement. We really need to push for institutionalization of Asian American studies within CUNY in a way that serves the students. And, it needs to get more resources than it has. And so that's one way to start at the college level and then work our way back to high school and middle school.
Thank you, Chris. Our next person to speak, Julie Su.
Do you think that it would be helpful to have more media representation of minority groups getting along and something more positive rather than, you know, one minority hurting another minority? And I think media plays a tremendous role in the way people perceive an issue such as racism. I was just curious about what you thought of that.
No question. When you see the social media, you know, attacks that are played over and over again, almost all the time it's a black attacker, you know,
yes.
And it gets just like over and over again. That's why the media narratives are so poisonous and they operate almost invisibly. I mean, I go to TikTok and I watch black creators, and many of them, if not most of them, are talking about this in a way that I don't see in the media. They're like, yo, we got to stop. We got to, you know, gotta work together. They were out here for us during Black Lives Matter. We got to work with stop anti-Asian hate. I'm like, I don't ever see these guys on like mainstream media. And I almost like as a corrective, like I like flip through TikTok for like 20 minutes just to see the voices, just to remind myself, right? Like, this is not a monolith. We tell people all the time, Asian Americans are not a monolith. And then we forget, hey, they're not a monolith either. And I remind myself on some, like, it's like my own medicine. Like, I take it just to be like, yes, people are people. We understand there's issues.
There's an addict to TikTok.
Pretty soon I'm going to do
it. You're absolutely right. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Judy. Online, we had inside the chat box, someone asked about microaggressions. Just so you know, we do have an expert at CUNY, Dr. Kevin Nadal. He's at John Jay College of Criminal Justice and the CUNY Graduate Center. He has previously given talks about microaggression and also written about it in the CUNY forum. So if you actually check out the CUNY forum online, you can find out more information about that. I also sent back a reply in the Q&A box, so the audience should be able to see the link to Dr. Nadal's talk. Let's see. We will entertain, let's say, two more questions because we're already over time. So Sarah Tam is a lawyer. So, and I think she knows you, Chris. So,
okay. Yes. And I know Sarah. And
everyone knows Chris.
Sarah, hi, Anthony.
Run for mayor.
Hi, Karen. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
Thanks so much. hope to meet you all and see you in person again soon. Something that has been on my mind, over the past year, and especially the past couple of weeks, is I guess just feeling like it's hard to kind of see the same type of mainstream mobilization of support and action that we did, with BLM a few months ago. And I guess I just wondered what your thoughts were in terms of kind of how, we can kind of encourage more people to kind of be involved and sort of feel like they want to make a change as well.
Do something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like,
Chris,
on my social media and my, I am in all of this.
Yeah.
And I see all the news and I feel like I'm telling my friends about it and you're talking to, talking about it as much as I can. But, after a certain time, it's like, it's, I don't want to say disheartening, but it's, it makes it hard when I feel like I don't have that type of response, except for, oh, I feel sorry that that's happening.
Yeah. Yeah. So as you, Anthony, as you might know, Sarah is related to Thomas Tam.
Yes, I know.
So, you know, we have a family member from CUNY, basically part of the CUNY family. Mm-hmm. You know, I am seeing an unprecedented response to this from the mainstream institutions. That may be relative for Asian Americans, where we're not used to seeing that response, but I would say that I am sensing and feeling an unprecedented response. I see unprecedented money flowing into Asian American nonprofits, which means that in the next year or two, we're going to see so much more stuff programmatically for Asian Americans, because we're actually probably now funded in a way that's a lot more in line with our numbers. I'm seeing people have called me up that, like, I've never seen them be politically active. You know, they're like, what can we do? I saw you on the TV. And I'm like, oh, okay, let me try to figure something out for you, right? And so, you know, I'm really, like, I'm heartened, because I guess as someone that's done it, you know, and you know, comparing to BLM, it's hard. African Americans been here longer. Their freedom struggle has gone on hundreds of years. I mean, they didn't get to where they are right now, like in a concentrated form. For many years, they were suffering many setbacks, right? And so, I mean, we have been here in large numbers really since 65. There have been many of us that have been here before that, but that's small compared to who came after. And that's one way of remembering how it takes time. It takes time to people to get established. It takes time for them to take care of their families. It takes time for their children like us to grow up here, go through the system, have enough time and resources and consciousness to make political change and to affect political change. So I would say don't feel down about it. It's actually an unprecedented moment. And I'm hoping that when Russell and I do that next program, you know, that we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about how this is an unprecedented moment, because I'm seeing it. I'm experiencing it. And it's here, you know. And I'm experiencing things that I've never sort of experienced before. Like next week, you know, I've been on Metro Focus, which is a local PBS program. They have a big focus on race. They asked me to be on there to talk about Derek Chauvin's trial and anti-Asian hate. And I don't think that would have happened before. There's a consciousness about Asian American issues in a way that I have never experienced in my lifetime. I'm 47, you know, and I'm enthused. So actually, I would say feel good about it. It's happening, you know, like it's happening now in a way I haven't seen in my lifetime. And that, you know, is unprecedented.
And the sheer dialogue and, you know, public discourse about these topics is itself very, very, very helpful to framing how we think about the community and how we react to incidents and, you know, kind of getting over the sort of initial not wanting to get involved in, you know, when we see something happening. I do think that there's a lot of progress now because of the dialogue and the public education that comes with it, that kind of community consciousness has such a dramatic impact on day-to-day lives.
Thank you. That puts things into perspective
and Sarah,
it's encouraging. You're right.
And you've invited us to your workplace, and we're coming. We're coming.
Yes. No, we're
coming. And then to the point that, like, our presentation can be a platform for the Asian American group and yourself to platform. That's why we're doing these things. That's why we're doing a traveling roadshow. You know, like, we're going to show up to your workplace and give you that platform. You give us that platform, we're going to give you the other platform to springboard. And so we're just going to go everywhere that we're invited to do that. And that's part of our mission at Abney, and that's part of the paper. And Karen and I have been so, I think, honored to do that, you know.
Yes, awesome. And thank you so much as well for doing it and kind of making it a platform and kind of trying to get it around to as many, you know, hosting organizations as you can. I know you all have day jobs as well.
Did I forgot?
I forgot about that too.
Thank you.
We'll take one more question. Anybody want to raise their hand?
I don't know if I had answered Elam's question or if his question was answered, but I want to answer real quick because I'm a labor and employment lawyer. And I've experienced that in my own workplace where I was asking to go to an Asian American conference and I wanted my workplace to cover it. And they said, what does this have to do with the work we're doing here at the EOC? And I stopped. And I was like, well, let me tell you what it has to do with the work that we're doing in the EOC. Everything. you know, and I think part of it is recognizing those moments, and you kind of have to practice. Like, you know, that's what Kevin A. Dahl's very good presentation about microaggression says, practice your responses. Know what is coming and then be able to point it out in a constructive, you know, nice way, because it might be coming, you know, from your managers. But just say, what are you talking? Let me tell you how. Like, you got to educate people. And that's our burden in a way. We have to educate them. Be prepared to do that in a, you know, constructive and, you know, constructive way. And then, you know, you can do it in an angry way later if it's not going anywhere. But I think that we need to be, you know, political. And but we also need to be like, all right, fine. If you don't know, let me tell you. Fine. You know? Yeah.
Before we conclude, I just want to let everybody know about some upcoming events. For the details, you can access them on the events calendar of our homepage. Tomorrow, Asians Fighting Injustice, a nonprofit organization, are holding an emergency rally to stop Asian tomorrow afternoon, 1 p.m. at Columbus Park in Manhattan's Chinatown. Be there. Bring your friends. Everybody is welcome to learn, find out what's going on, and, you know, do something. The Asian American Federation is hosting a panel, A Year of Hate, Where Do We Go From Here? On Tuesday, April the 6th. Panelists include Dr. Kevin A. Dahl, professor of psychology from John Jay and CUNY Graduate Center, as well as opening speaker will be Noel Quintana, the individual who was slashed across the face in the subway. He'll be there. And then once again, there was the Queens District Attorney's Office is hosting a panel, Combating Anti-Asian Hate Crimes, Wednesday, April the 7th. And with that, I want to thank Chris and Karen for joining us tonight for this important topic, and thank everyone for joining us at home on a Good Friday. And enjoy your Easter weekend, and please stay healthy, safe, and be an upstander in the face of hate. There's resources online from individual groups such as I Holla Back and the Asian American Federation with ways to defend yourself, as well as stand up to incidences that you see on the street and help your fellow person. That's all we can do. Don't, you know, do something, you know, help out, document, make sure people are okay. And yeah, good night, everybody. And thank you, Chris and Karen.
Thank you.
Thank you, Anthony. Thank you, everyone.